Today is December the 19th, 2018.
Do you know who has your personal data? Let me ask the question differently. Do you know who is using your personal data besides Facebook and Google? Welcome to the Personal Computer Show. This is the original personal computer radio show of All Things Computing. I'm Hank Key and my colleague is Joe King. At the start of the new year, 2019, the Personal Computer Show will be reformatted to be oriented to internet broadcasting. The cord cutting of the past few years have shown a shift in listeners and viewers from tuning into traditional media platforms to receiving their content on demand when it is convenient for them. We are not ending the show, just the over-air broadcast. The program will continue to be available on PRN.fm on the internet as it is presently scheduled on Wednesday, 6 p.m. Eastern Time. Podcasts of the programs will continue to be available from PRN.fm or the major podcast hosting sites, as well as our website, PCRadioshow.org. In this new format, we can continue to be heard regularly every week. The on-air radio program broadcasting from WBAI-FM 99.5 New York has been subjected to so many unannounced preemptions that many listeners don't know if we're on or if we're off. Indeed, some major sites such as The Well in Silicon Valley have prematurely announced our demise earlier in the year. We will go back to our roots in which you, the listening audience, are part of the program. WBAI has not had a telephone system for our listeners to call since we moved out of the Wall Street studios in 2012 in the aftermath of Hurricane Sandy. If you send us your question or a brief description of what you want to discuss via email, along with your telephone number and a convenient time at which we can reach you, we will call you and record the call for broadcast during the show. If you have any questions or comments for us, just send us an email address to hank@pcradioshow.org. Just remember, there's no such thing as a stupid question. The conversation will be recorded to be part of the show, but if you are bashful or shy or just want to remain anonymous, it's no problem. We'll just use the context of what is on your mind and attribute it to a query received in our mailbag, without identifying who wrote us the email. And if you prefer, we do have associates on the air with their feature segments. If you want them to answer your question, we can make arrangements for that too. You, the listening audience, are not the product for the Personal Computer Show, but are an integral part of the show. Just as personal computing has morphed into different supporting platforms since we first broadcast live in 1983, broadcasting on local radio stations has morphed into worldwide podcasting. We hope you will join us in this exciting new adventure and format. Send email to me, hank@pcradioshow.org, and let's talk about your computing problems or, better yet, whatever questions or opinions you have about computing. I open each show with the questions. Do you know who has your data besides Google and Facebook? Do you know who's using your data? I have reported that Google Timeline is Google tracking your every move without much fanfare. Selling location data collected by mobile phones has become a big business. Location advertising sales are expected to reach $21 billion this year. At least 75 companies receive anonymous, precise location data from applications with the location services features activated. Several of these outfits claim to track 200 million mobile devices in the United States, about half of all devices in the country. The data is very accurate, coming within a few yards of a person's whereabouts at a point in time, and is updated often, as frequently as 14,000 times a day. With that kind of accuracy and frequency, calling the data anonymous is really quite misleading. If you are collecting a person's location over time and it is tied to a unique identifier, it's disingenuous to call that anonymous. If you have information about where people are going and where people live, you can build a story of who that location data belongs to. Someone can learn a lot about you from your location. They can tell what your interests are and who you're meeting with. Your location data tells more about you than your social security number. Businesses that collect consumer data typically say they're not interested in individuals, but in patterns. Data collected on individuals is anonymized by attaching it to an ID number. However, that ID number really is readily accessible in raw location data. Those people who include employees or customers of the data collector still could identify individuals without their consent. Not surprisingly, the leaders in location-based advertising are Google and Facebook. Both companies offer mobile apps that they use to collect location data. They say they don't sell the data, but use it only internally to personalize services, sell targeted ads online, and determine if the ads lead to sales in the physical world. Some large companies have started to get in front of the location data issue before it becomes a problem for them. For example, Verizon and AT&T announced during the summer that they would stop selling their customers' location data to data brokers. Most mobile apps request permission to use a device's location services before accessing them, but that process could be misleading. An app might ask for location services access for one purpose, but use the information for multiple purposes. Not all app notices are perfectly clear as to what location data is being used for. Often the app will ask, "Do you want us to use your location to provide you with the local weather information, or personalize your experience, or improve the accuracy of the maps that you're using?" They don't list all other purposes the data will be used for, like advertising and sales to third parties. Some 1,400 popular applications contain code to share location information. About 1,200 were written for the Android phones and 200 for the Apple models. In a sample of 17 apps sending precise location data, 3 Apple iOS programs and 1 Android offering mentioned that location data could be used for advertising while seeking permission to access the service. Understanding what's done with location data can be an onerous task for a consumer. It requires reading user agreements and privacy policies and changing settings for all the apps on a phone. That can be incredibly time-consuming. No individual has the capacity to do that properly, and it's not a burden that we should be placing on individuals that depend on location-based services. How concerned are consumers about possible abuse of their location information? Most consumers don't care, but there's a creepiness factor that bothers them a little bit. We've all been on the web and looked at a new pair of shoes or something along that order, and all of a sudden, all you see in your browser for hours on end are ads for those items. The same kind of thing is happening with your physical location. Stores are tracking your location and will start pushing suggestions to you based on where you went in that store. Consumers are very concerned about what's being done with their location data. The problem isn't that consumers are not concerned, it's that even if you're very concerned, it's impossible for anyone to have the capacity and time to understand all the things companies are doing with your data and then go into your settings and make the choices that align perfectly with your own personal privacy interests. What really needs to happen is for our laws to recognize that location privacy in a commercial context has to be built into any service. Congress should pass a commercial privacy law, which would include limits on how companies can collect and use location information. Some uses of information shouldn't be allowed even with consent. One of the uses might be repurposing of location information. Collecting the information for a location-based service, then reusing it for something completely unrelated, like location-based advertising, or selling it to a data broker. Do you know who has your data besides Google and Facebook? Do you know how that data is being used?
Is text messaging taxable? The California Public Utilities Commission had originally proposed a tax on text messaging. The tax would have cost customers an additional $1.40 for $20 of texting charges. But the Utilities Commission said the Federal Communications Commission, which is the FCC, rule internet service providers as an information service rather than a common carrier. The California Public Utilities Commission announced that it would not tax residents' cell phone plan, reversing course on a proposal to add a new monthly fee on texting in hopes of increasing funding to a program that finances services like 911 and subsidizes phone rates for low-income Californians. The change rule came when the FCC said text messaging is an information service and not a telecommunication service. That means states have a limited authority over texting. As originally proposed, iMessage by Apple would not have been taxed as Apple is not a common carrier. If you're connected to Wi-Fi, you can use iMessage. It does not use your cellular data or text messaging plan. iMessage uses a different technology to connect to the internet. They are functionally the same as regular cellular text messaging, but using a different means of communication. Last year, the FCC voted to strip net neutrality protections from the internet and reclassify internet service providers as an information service rather than a common carrier. This year, the FCC has voted to classify text messaging the same way. This classification is not just a minor legal technicality. The Electronic Frontier Foundation, that's the EFF, joined 19 other groups in signing a letter urging the FCC to either classify SMS and short codes as a common carrier or at least wait to make a decision until the effects of classifying text messaging as an information service could be studied under today's circumstances. Classifying text messages under Title II would require wireless carriers to contribute to the Universal Service Fund, which funds initiatives, among other things, increase the availability and affordability of phone and internet services to rural and low-income users. Title II classification would also prevent wireless companies from interfering with text messaging and operate in a non-discriminatory manner. Californians can continue now their carefree texting for the foreseeable future. History shows us that when the wireless carriers exerted discretion over text messaging, it effectively amounted to censorship and hampered the ability of people and groups to organize. In 2007, Verizon blocked text messaging from NARO on the grounds of controversy. In 2010, T-Mobile was accused of blocking texts from a medical marijuana service. That same year, Sprint demanded Catholic Relief Services end a texting-based drive to raise money that was started as a response to the earthquake in Haiti. This is a problem that spans wireless companies and issues. Classifying texting under Title I as an information service means no oversight when this keeps happening. It means even less money for people who don't have access to the internet. It means that political activity over critical messaging too would be subject to a gatekeeper rather than open to all on reasonable and just terms. It means that wireless carriers can block text messages whenever they want. It serves wireless companies' interests, but it does little for you, the user. But classifying text messaging as common carrier enables states to enact tax on its usage. The following comments are strictly my own personal opinion on net neutrality. The opinion is not necessarily shared by my colleagues. Net neutrality, as proposed, affects only telecom companies under FCC regulation, but you have big tech companies providing the same function, which are regulated by the FTC, the Federal Trade Commission. Google, Facebook, and Apple would have benefited with the enactment of net neutrality. They were all for it on net neutrality under the FCC, as it does not apply to them. Google calls their service Google Fiber. Google Fiber provides an internet connection speed of up to 1 gigabit per second for both download and upload, which is roughly 100 times faster access than what most Americans have. Google Fiber says its service allows for the download of a full movie in less than 2 minutes. Apple iMessage uses Wi-Fi. If Wi-Fi is unavailable, iMessages are sent over cellular data. What is the answer?
Congress needs to enact legislation that doesn't split regulation of the internet between two separate government agencies. Apple has been slashing iPhone prices. Forbes News reported Apple slashing prices, and Barron's reports Apple will not have a 5G-capable iPhone in 2019. This backs up an exclusive report from Bloomberg last week, which claimed it will be at least 2020 before iPhones can use 5G. With 5G performance looking very positive, major networks around the world are already rolling it out, and AT&T and Verizon have already confirmed a 5G Samsung Galaxy phone is coming soon. The trouble for Apple is repeating its historical pattern of belated upgrades, such as iPhone adoption of 3G and 4G was a year late. On the design front, Apple looks set to be returning Touch ID to iPhones to regenerate excitement. Its current user base is largely happy with Face ID and already persuaded by Apple's somewhat misleading claims that it is more secure than Touch ID. In which case, Apple's new era of iPhone price cuts looks set to continue, especially if iOS quality control continues to let show-stopping bugs to slip into final releases. Apple is having trouble selling its latest iPhones, according to many numerous reports. Bloomberg reported that Apple has revved up their marketing efforts to try to boost the sales of their latest phones and have started offering more generous than usual trade-in terms for older phones. For the first time in recent memory, Apple reportedly sent a push alert from the Apple Store to iPhone customers to advertise the new phones. Apple has been advertising the new iPhone XR at a too-good-to-be-true price at $449, which is $300 below what you actually would have to pay for it. However, people have to notice the asterisk besides the number that they have to trade in a recent phone that's in good condition to get that low, low price. But those are only the latest signs that Apple is struggling to find buyers for the new phones. The Wall Street Journal reported earlier this month that Apple twice cut back on orders for the iPhone XR and also slashed orders on their XS models. Apple's biggest manufacturing partner, Foxconn, is cutting costs and warning of a tough year ahead. Investor fears when you offer a weaker-than-expected sales forecast for the holiday quarter and announce that Apple will stop their long-standing practice of reporting how many iPhones and other devices are sold. Apple iPhones are really pricey. Apple seems to be having particular trouble selling its new iPhone XR. When they debuted the iPhone in 2007, it was considered by many to be extravagantly costly. Its price was $499 for the base model, or about $606 in today's money given inflation. The least expensive of the recent models, the XR, cost nearly $150 more than that inflation-adjusted figure. The flagship model, the iPhone XS Max, has a starting price that's almost double it. Today's phones are better than those of their first models. They have bigger, higher-resolution screens and much faster processors. They have much improved camera and built-in facial recognition systems. They can do things those first phones couldn't, such as shooting movies, making video calls, and running multiple apps at the same time. But you know what? Lots of other phones offer similar capabilities these days, and some really good ones cost hundreds of dollars less than the Apple iPhones. Apple has been hiking prices on many of their products, not just iPhones, and putting an emphasis on things that appeared to higher-end consumers. Higher prices, though, are depressing sales. Even though they got a big boost from raising prices last year, that's starting to look like a one-trick pony. On average, Wall Street analysts are forecasting that the number of iPhones they sell for this fiscal year is going to be below last year, as some analysts think the situation is going to be worse. Consumers are already holding onto their phones longer and are planning to wait longer to replace them. In other words, for many customers, new features like the Face ID facial recognition system or bigger screens aren't going to be the convincing factors for them to buy a new phone if the phones cost too much.
It's not a surprise that higher prices have become a problem. The number of people who can afford to plunk down $1,000 or more for a phone is fairly small. The number who can afford to do that every 18 months is even smaller. iPhone prices are a particular problem in developing countries such as India, which is one of the few places around the world where smartphone growth is still strong. Apple is having a tough time gaining traction in India simply because their phones cost too much. An iPhone XS can cost more than half the average Indian's annual income. If you want to compete there, you're going to have to cut prices or offer lower-cost models. Apple can afford a price cut. The selling of iPhones is linked to their new focus on services. However, the service is linked to the number of iPhones they sell. The fewer phones that customers buy, the fewer warranties that Apple is likely to sell, and the less opportunities Apple will get to convince people to sign up for their music service or cloud storage. And look, Apple can easily afford to cut prices. Finally, it would be the right thing to do by your customers. You've got some of the most loyal customers in the world. For Apple, they've already been willing to pay a substantially higher premium for the products because they felt your products were well-designed and easy to use. But the latest round of price hikes have felt a lot like you are taking advantage of that loyalty to gouge them. Apple can fix this. The answer is simple and easy. Just cut the prices and it's really not that hard. Our feature segments tonight are Health and Wearable Technologies by Dr. Alfred Poor, and he'll be talking about weightlifting reduces chances of heart attack or stroke. He'll also cover electronic skin detects earth magnetic fields, and he's going to cover Google Glass project at Stanford helps autistic children detect emotions. From the tech corner, I'm going to cover what to do when your system cannot start up cleanly or it just doesn't turn on. And Marty Winston in home automation, he'll have last-minute ideas for the holiday shopper.
Hello, this is Alfred Poor with news about wearables and digital health technology from Health Tech Insider.
You know, it's too bad they don't make those big fat phone books anymore, because it could save your life. Now, that sounds a little silly, but it's based on research that's come out of Iowa State University, and they were looking at exercise and what impact that can have on your risk of having a heart attack or stroke. And specifically, they were looking at resistance exercise. And this is the kind of exercise you get when you're lifting weights. It's not aerobic exercise, where you have to run and get your heart rate up and start breathing hard. It's just weightlifting. And they found that if you do weightlifting for as little as 1 hour a week, that's like 10 minutes a day, if you can do that for an hour a week, it can reduce your chances of a heart attack or stroke by 40 to 70%. That's a huge reduction. And they found that if you spend more than an hour a week, it doesn't make a whole lot of difference. It's that first hour a week that makes all the difference. And another interesting fact on this was it didn't matter whether or not you did aerobic exercise as well. If you don't do any, apparently you still get that same 40 to 70% benefit. So this is a really interesting development. It may point the way to helping people with busy schedules getting at least some exercise and be able to improve their health. Again, you don't need weights, you just need the physical resistance. So it's something that you could do at home in many cases. And so it's an interesting development and one more way that we're learning about how we can keep ourselves healthy and reduce our chances of illness. One of the problems that I talk about a lot with wearables is how do you control them? If these are tiny little devices that disappear into our lives and become part of our clothing or embedded in our skin or whatever, the smaller they get, the harder it is to control them. And how do you come up with a user interface that allows you to control these devices? Well, we've talked about a lot of different approaches using proximity detectors and all kinds of sensors, but there's a group in Germany that has come up with a very interesting design that could change the way we control our wearables. They've come up with an electronic skin, a very thin film, flexible, stretchable material that has sensors built into it. And it's, you know, basically like a temporary tattoo. But they've discovered that they can make something that is so sensitive that it can detect the magnetic fields of the Earth. Sort of like homing pigeons and how they navigate. Well, this device is so sensitive that it can tell which direction it's pointing. If it points north, it produces the greatest voltage from the sensors. And when it's pointing south, it creates the least amount of voltage. And so the signal varies from which way you're pointing. And as you move towards or away from north or south, it can detect the motion. So it can be used for gesture control. So you wave your hand and it can actually determine the motion of your hand, and that could be used as an input for a user interface. They created a system using a video game where you could control the motion of a little animated panda bear on the screen and change its direction and make it go forward or backward depending on how you moved your hand. But this could be used for all kinds of things, from controlling wearable devices to machine interface with smart prosthetics, to even just helping people navigate by letting them know which direction they're headed based on this thin skin-like sensor that you can put on. So still in the labs, but it's an interesting development and a very interesting sensor technology that could have all kinds of applications. Remember Google Glass? Google's ill-fated attempt for an augmented reality device? Well, a lot of people think that Google Glass is dead, but that's not true. It actually lives on and is really quite successful in the enterprise arena, where it's used for helping workers refer to documentation and other information sources while they're working and keeping their hands free, and can also communicate with others. There's a lot of things that you can do with augmented reality, and Google Glass is one of the many products that are out there that are being used for that kind of purpose. But there's another use for augmented reality, and there's a project at Stanford University that's working with this. It's basically for people with autism. One of the problems with people on the autistic spectrum is that they can have a hard time determining a person's emotion while they're interacting with them. They're just not sensitive to those visual and verbal clues that they might get. Well, the Autism Glass Project is using Google Glass devices to help with facial recognition and artificial intelligence determine the emotional cues that the person is giving who the subject is interacting with. So it looks at facial expressions and so forth. They're actually actively recruiting families with children from 4 to 17 who are on the autistic spectrum. At this point, they're only working with families in the Bay Area, in San Francisco area, but their hope is eventually to bring the study nationwide and get more people involved. We have information for their website and an email that you can contact the coordinators if you're interested. You can find that on the Health Tech Insider site.
For more information, go to healthtechinsider.com. This is Alfred Poor. Thanks for listening.
Thank you, Alfred. What do you do when your system can't start up cleanly or just doesn't turn on? Last Wednesday, I had finished editing the weekly broadcast at about 2 a.m. in the morning, and there was a message that Windows Update would start up. I opted to let the Windows Update proceed as I was tired. I did not back up the completed broadcast. I just went to sleep. I woke up at about 8 a.m. and got back onto the system. The system booted up asking for the Windows password. I had none to begin with. Only option was entering the password or click on I forgot password. Each time I clicked on I forgot password, I received a message to enter password or click on I forgot password. Each time I turned off the machine and restarted, the same message popped up on the screen. I went into action on Plan A to get the system up and running. I tried booting up with warm restart on a number of occasions to no avail, and now it was time to go into Plan B. I pulled out the Windows installation distribution to do an initial system boot, and I selected the Windows System Restore option. There were about 9 different points of options available for me to use.
I went through each restore attempt, and it failed. I wasn't flustered yet. I just moved on to Plan C. Next option was to restore to the previous build. Unfortunately, the previous build was corrupted. Well, I next tried to do a factory reset without losing data. Murphy's Law was in effect. It was not possible to do a clean system install without erasing the data. I had just spent 3 hours trying to retrieve the data, and the clock was ticking. So, rather than spend any more time on it, I called Microsoft support. The technician suggested all the steps I had gone through. His final recommendation was just do a factory reset, forget about any data being available. According to him, there was no other option. But in the back of my mind, I always had a last resort. I removed the hard disk drive from the notebook in question and installed the hard drive into an external enclosure. This in turn was connected to another system I had available. This enabled me to recover last week's broadcast. When you are removing any component part from a notebook, just remember to disconnect the AC power and remove the battery from the unit first. What lessons were to be learned? Well, turn off the automatic Windows update and do the manual update, and don't feel bad that you're not doing an update immediately as soon as it's released. In fact, I would hold off until there's no other complaints on it. There had been a lot of complaints about the Windows 10 update, release 1807. Make sure your system restore for the drive C is on, because that's where your operating system is. And in my case, I had on hand a spare external enclosure, and if you don't have one, you can get one for about $10 at Micro Center so that you can move the hard or solid-state drive into that enclosure. Also have available a Windows 10 distribution media available. If you don't have it, there is a website you can go to. It's called windowsiso.net. That's one word, windowsiso.net. They have many of the 7, 8, 8.1, and 10 distributions of Windows available. In my case, for Windows 10, I keep the releases that were in 2015 and 2016. I don't necessarily have to worry about keeping up to date on 17 and 18. Reasons are very simple. If you install Windows from 2015 or 2016, it would do a free upgrade of 7 or 8.1 to Windows 10. If you use the later ones, it won't. Download the hardware maintenance manual so you know how to open up the unit to remove the hard disk drive. If you do not or are unable to get a clean boot, try restore to a prior system restore point that was working. If unsuccessful, try all other restore points. If that is unsuccessful, then restore to a prior build. If that is unsuccessful, well, you know the drill. What if you're still running with Windows 7? Is the recovery process any different? Yes, there are some slight differences. The recovery program disk for Windows 7 has to be created from Windows 7 itself. If you had not created the recovery media for Windows 7, do so now. What if your system is down and you cannot create this disk? Well, find a buddy who's still running Windows 7. What if you are like most computer users? The Windows 7 installation disk is somewhere in a safe place. It is so safe you don't remember where you put it. On later Windows 7 purchase units, the Windows 7 operating system distribution is in a hidden partition. In earlier units, the distribution was supplied on separate media. If you misplace your Windows 7 installation disk, which may be the actual disk that came with your PC or a retail Windows 7 installed disk that you bought separately, you can still get a copy of the Windows 7 installation distribution from Microsoft at a modest cost if you provide them with your system product code. Alternatively, you can get a free copy from windowsiso.net, or that's windowsiso.net, without providing the product code. The version of Windows 7 is also important, as product keys will only work with certain versions of Windows. Simply launch the Start menu, right-click on Computer, and select Properties from the context menu. Of course, you can also look on the box or documentation that came with the Windows 7 purchase. If you provide Microsoft with just the product code, Microsoft will figure out what version of Windows 7 is needed based on the product key and give you links to download that version. If you don't have your product key, run the utility from magicaljellybean.com to get the info. The product code label for Windows 7 is affixed also on your system unit. It may have faded or fallen off. You can still find the product key by downloading and running the utility from magicaljellybean.com. The only other difference from the Windows 10 recovery is you need to also download a copy of the Windows 10 installation distribution. This will enable you to still upgrade Windows 7 to 10 for free if the build is 2015 or 2016. The later copies of Windows 10 will upgrade 7 to 10 only if the image of the Windows 10 upgrade is on the disk. Like many Windows 7 users, you may want to replace the hard disk drive with a solid-state drive, giving you a performance boost as well as more time to upgrade to Windows 10. Christmas is less than a week away, and you only have a few days left for holiday shopping. Most of you don't know that Marty reviews hundreds of products each year, and he's cherry-picked a few to tell you about tonight.
Oh, brother. Hey, listen, everybody. I can recommend a lot of products that you may want to consider. Not everybody will want every bit of it, but I'll start rattling off my list of picks. And let me suggest this. If you hear me mention something that sounds interesting, remember that there are archives of this show available when you go to http://pcradioshow2.org. Every one of these products is something that I got in here for an editorial review and especially liked. So here we go. From Klein Tools, a very cool 12-compartment transport tool case, quite literally made to tote the tools and connectors and test gear and things that geeks like us can never seem to have all in one place. It's built like a cross between a tackle box and a travel case. 12 removable small compartments in the cover, cantilevered top, and 6 longer, deeper compartments underneath. That's the Klein Tools Transport Tool Case. Hand trucks tend to have two wheels, but the UpCart Lift stair-climbing hand truck replaces each of those wheels with a trio of smaller wheels on a Y-shaped mount, so the centers of those wheels form a triangle. On flat or ramped ground, two wheels on each side are on the ground. When you come to steps, the triangle rotates, so there's one wheel on the lower step and one on the higher step, which my back and my arms can tell you makes carrying loads up or downstairs a whole bunch easier. When you're done using it, the handle telescopes down, the front platform folds up, the wheels fold back, and the whole thing stows in roughly the amount of space it would take to hold an attaché case. That's the UpCart Lift stair-climbing hand truck. You remember transistor radios? Back in the 1950s, they were battery-powered portable radios you could fit into a shirt pocket. Today, a Sanjian DT800 AM-FM weather radio is just as small, lets you scan and store up to 20 each AM and FM stations, covers all 7 NOAA weather radio frequencies, shows digital station and content info, has a clock, and offers an alarm. You can listen through its speaker in mono or plug in your earbuds or a headphone for stereo. And it's radio over the air, so you don't use up your data plan to listen. That's a Sanjian DT800 AM-FM weather pocket radio. Ubio, that's spelled U-B-I-O, sent me a 500-watt-hour power box, about twice as big as a lunchbox, and sporting more kinds of power than I ever remember seeing in a portable package. There are 2 AC outlets, good for up to 300 watts total, a 12-volt accessory plug, hey, I used to call them lighter plugs, good for 10 amps. There's a whole line of USB power ports. 2 of them are USB-C, 2 are USB-A at 2.4 amps, and 2 of them are USB-A with Quick Charge 3. There are also 2 LED lights, one on each side, each separately controlled by a push button that can take it through 4 levels of brightness. Take this 500-watt-hour power box onto the field or camping or use it as a very versatile benchtop power source from, again, Ubio, U-B-I-O. Sharp sent me a new kind of countertop appliance that uses superheated steam and two radiant panels to do a lot of different kinds of cooking, baking, toasting, broiling, and more. It works at temperatures up to 485 degrees, that's Fahrenheit, and I love this. You don't have to thaw anything before you put it in to cook. Rock hard frozen is fine, and its chamber is big enough to fit a 12-inch pizza. Our results with it have been exceptional, and superheated steam is dry, much too hot to condense. The very first thing I did was to stick a piece of bread in and toast it. It came out, well, as dry as toast. That's the Sharp Superheated Steam Countertop Oven. This next one is a little pricey, but it can save you more than it costs you. It's a different and in some ways more primitive kind of surge protector, but a lot more effective than newer technologies, and it doesn't sacrifice itself to big surges and spikes like the MOV products do. I got in the Surgex SA20. That's the 20-amp model. You might be okay with the SA15 15-amp module. A really simple box with a power cord and, on its face, two outlets. There isn't any of the bad stuff that might be ready to fry your gear at the outlet you plug into that doesn't get stopped before it can reach the outlets on the box. And I mean brute force, big league stopped. That's the Surgex SA20 for me, or SA15 for you. I get really frustrated with most of the products out there that want to turn off the water mains when something detects a leak, especially when, hey, in my opinion, they unnecessarily involve cloud connections and handset apps, but I did get one product in that makes nothing but sense. Have you ever had a washing machine hose burst? There's tons of water everywhere, even if it happens while you're right in front of it. The LeakSmart washing machine kit is a self-contained system. It has adapters for the hot and cold water lines that feed the washing machine. The adapters have motorized shutoff valves inside, plus a controller box and a water sensor you can put right on the floor, right behind the machine, where nobody will ever kick it out of the way. If one of those hoses ever bursts, it shuts the water off before you could even reach back to touch the valve on the wall. That could potentially save you a five-figure water damage repair. That's the LeakSmart washing machine kit. Here's one that will make you cry. Oello, that's spelled O-E-L-O, makes color-controllable LED light pucks on strips, so you can mount them to your outside walls just under the gutter line and let their handset app set up whatever colors or patterns you want to choose for the decorative lighting in your house. You might do red and green for Christmas, or blue and white for Hanukkah, or green and white when the Jets are playing, or blue and orange for the Mets. Throbbing red for Valentine's Day, green for St. Patrick's Day, red, white, blue for 4th of July, you get it. Its LEDs are rated for 100,000 hours. That's Oello, spelled O-E-L-O. Swiffer Continuous Clean is a cylinder with a fan and a filter bag inside. The fan draws in air and inflates the bag, which traps things like dust and pet hair and only lets clean air back into the room. Very quiet, almost silent. It's been running in my living room since I got it. The Swiffer Continuous Clean. Sir La Table sent a stick-free ScanPan CS Plus skillet. Really different. You can use metal utensils with it. No sweat. It's dishwasher safe. The entire pan is oven safe to 500 degrees Fahrenheit. It heats evenly, and you only need a little butter or oil to keep food from clinging. That's the ScanPan CS Plus skillet from Sir La Table. Strauss Brands sells fresh meat online, so I agreed to review the viability of getting meat that way. Looking at the nature of the process and both the quality of the cut to the eye as delivered and the flavor once cooked. A look at the website, and a few days later, a package with better insulating foam than usual and less dry ice than usual came to the door. The contents still safely frozen. It keeps getting better. The marbling in the meat, the very thorough rending of the after-trim edge fat on the grill, and a flavor that turned our inner carnivore voracious. Well, they were all that we would expect from farm, not factory meat, which seems to support Strauss's claims for their free Raise Direct program. Now, stand by for my big reveal. It was a 2-inch-thick, 28-ounce bone-in cowboy ribeye steak. Strauss Brands delivered everything they promised and more, and that steak isn't the only choice they offer. OVLED is one of those head-worn LED lights, but it doesn't look like or work like the others. It doesn't have the usual lump in the front. Instead, it uses an array of 20 LEDs on a flexible ribbon. When you turn it on, you don't just get a spot of light. You get something more, well, more than a semicircle of even bright light. By bright, I mean 300 lumens, same light that a 40-watt bulb puts out. And it runs on 3 AAA cells, so when it starts to dim, you can just pop in another 3 AAAs and get going. No wait for a recharge. That's OVLED, OVLED. Works, WORX, sent their storage step stool. Kind of simple, kind of clever, kind of it's about time. If you live long enough, you'll see lots of workers standing on toolboxes to reach things just beyond arm's length, or sitting on a toolbox instead of squatting, kneeling, or sitting on the ground. It looks like a utility 13-inch step stool, but the lid unclamps to open up a deep compartment where tools or hardware or lunch can go, and underneath that, a slide-out drawer can tote even more. That top lid also has a fold-up handle to make it easier to carry to where the work is. That's the Storage Step Stool from Works, W-O-R-X. If you like experimenting with electronics, things like sensors and motors and control systems, maybe for building robots or just experimenting, or you know somebody any age who's got the bug, I've reviewed dozens of gizmos from three companies that are worth your attention. Their names are Parallax, Pololu, and SparkFun. They make a lot of the products they sell, and they also sell a lot of products that go with those. These are online businesses that are doing wonders for championing electronic experimentation and innovation. Three different companies. Those names again. Parallax, Pololu, that's P-O-L-O-L-U, and SparkFun. This next one isn't very technical at all. Gifts at Home is the name of the site where we found the Tech Tools brand desktop mini filing cabinet for business cards. It's less than 9 inches tall, looks like a tiny 3-drawer filing cabinet down to the silvery handles and label frame. And the drawers are perfectly sized for holding business cards, maybe 1,000 total. I had sorted stacks of cards all over my desk that are now in a safer and more organized place. That's the Tech Tools mini filing cabinet for business cards from Gifts at Home. CAD Audio. Surprisingly, not many people know about this company, even though some of their brands, like Astatic, have been around since 1933. Anyway, they sent me their Sessions headphones. The cushions surround your ears. That's called circumoral. And the back of the ear cup is solid, not vented. That's called closed back. You choose a closed back circumoral design when you want to be somewhat isolated from sounds in your surroundings, able to concentrate more on your listening. And these are great headphones for that. They are acoustically transparent, delivering the experience of being at the point of recording without distortion. And the faithful accuracy of that reproduction survived every setting of our volume control from 10% to 90%. They're the model MH510 Sessions headphones from CAD Audio. So that's more than a dozen things that I've had in to try out and use and covered in my reviews. And they may give you an idea or two for your own last-minute holiday shopping or for things you want to get for yourself with some of your after-holiday mad money. And to Hank, Joe, Alfred, and all of you, my best wishes for happy holidays and phenomenally, memorably, wonderfully great new year. You'll hear my forecast for what that may hold on next week's show. Cheers.
Thank you, Marty. Public service announcements. The following are computer club meetings in the New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut tri-state region. All these meetings are free and open to the public. The computer clubs have random access sessions at each of these club meetings. If you have any questions or need for technical advice, the club members are more than happy to assist. There is no such thing as a dumb question. The Brookdale Computer Users Group will have a presentation on what's new with Chromebooks in 2018. Thursday, December the 27th, meeting time is 7 p.m., and they meet at the Middletown Library Large Meeting Room at 55 New Monmouth Road in Middletown, New Jersey. The Westchester PC User Group will have a presentation on orienteering. It's the world of cartography or mapping. Thursday, January the 3rd, and meeting time is 7 p.m. at the Keller Williams Realty, 120 Bloomingdale Road, 1st floor, White Plains, New York. The Amateur Computer Group of New Jersey will meet Friday, January the 4th. Meeting time is 8 p.m., and they meet at the Scotch Plains Rescue Squad in Scotch Plains, New Jersey. The New York Amateur Computer Club has its meeting Thursday, January the 10th. Meeting time is 7 p.m. They meet at NYU, 32 Waverly Place, also known as the Silver Building, room 411 in Manhattan, New York. The Long Island Macintosh Users Group will meet Friday, January the 11th. Meeting time is 7 p.m., and they meet at the Harry J. Scherr Hall at the New York Institute of Technology, Old Westbury Campus in Old Westbury, New York. If you have any club meetings you want me to announce on your behalf on the air, send me a note. My address is hankkey@pcradioshow.org. We like to hear from you, and if you have any computer-related questions or comments, drop us a line at hankkey@pcradioshow.org. At the start of the new year, 2019, the Personal Computer Show will be reformatted to be oriented to internet broadcasting. The cord cutting of the past few years have shown a shift in listeners and viewers from tuning into traditional media platforms to receiving their content on demand when it is convenient for them. We are not ending the show, just the over-air broadcast. The program will continue to be available on PRN.FM, on the internet as it is presently scheduled on Wednesday, 6 p.m. Eastern Time. Podcasts of the programs will continue to be available from PRN.FM or the major podcast hosting sites, as well as our website, PCRadioshow.org. In this new format, we can continue to be heard regularly every week. We will go back to our roots in which you, the listening audience, are part of the program. If you send us your question or a brief description of what you want to discuss via email, along with your telephone number and a convenient time at which we can reach you, we will call you and record the call for broadcast during the show. If you have any questions or comments for us, just send us an email addressed to hank@pcradioshow.org. The conversation will be recorded to be part of the show, but if you are bashful or shy or just want to remain anonymous, it's no problem. We'll just use the context of what is on your mind and attribute it to a query received in our mailbag without identifying who wrote us the email. And if you prefer, we do have associates on the air with their feature segments if you want them to answer your question. We can make arrangements for that too. Just as personal computing has morphed into different supporting platforms, broadcasting on local radio stations has morphed into worldwide podcasting. We hope you will join us in this exciting new adventure and format. Send email to me, hank@pcradioshow.org, and let's talk about your computing problems, or better yet, whatever questions or opinions you have about computing. Our website is pcradioshow.org. We can be heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. on PRN.FM on the internet. If you have any questions for us, just send us an email addressed to hank@pcradioshow.org. In the meantime, stay in touch and keep on computing. And to paraphrase a noted Yuletide song, chestnuts roasting on an open fire. And so I'm offering this simple phrase to kids from 1 to 92, although it's been said many times in many ways, back up and back up your system. I'm Hank Key, and on behalf of Joe King, Michael Horowitz, Dr. Alfred Poor, and Marty Winston, we wish everyone a happy holiday and a Merry Christmas. We thank you for listening. Stay safe and healthy until we meet again. Same time, same station next week.